Hi, today is October 27th, 2023. I'm Todd Gosford. This is Bold News Podcast 432, and it is my distinct privilege and honor to have Dr. David Lasner, President of the University of Hawaii, as my very special guest today. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going, Todd?
It's been a long time since I've seen you. I think the last time I saw you was on the steps of the state capitol before the pandemic.
That sounds highly plausible.
But at any rate, and I'll be informal. I'll call him Dave for the podcast. And at one point, he was office neighbor. Well, he had office at a cubicle.
Yeah, I think that could be right. In Colorado, good old days of UH Computing Center.
Exactly. So he's done great things, and I retired. But anyway.
And I will be soon.
So I'm very privileged, and to find out that I have lunch with me, and let us talk about some of the old days, new days, because it comes to you fresh. What was your lunch?
Excellent.
Was it one of your comfort foods?
Indeed. Big city diner, meatloaf and garlic bread.
And I had a sauteed salmon, which is really good. Oh, the veggies are really good, too. And also something I shouldn't have eaten or drank, actually, was I have a living lemonade, which is probably more sugar than I ingested in the whole year. So far. But it's okay. It's a cheat day. So one of the things I remember about you is, and I heard that, was that you were running in charge, responsible or player. It was kind of a name.
Yeah. So I was a student at the University of Illinois, my great state school, where I graduated from high school. And I went in my math class. One of the guys in my calculus class was a townie. And one day after class, he said, "Oh, you should come over and see this cool computer system."
Yeah.
And that's when I got introduced to Plato. This is 1972.
Wow.
And I walked into this room full of these terminals, and it was the best graphic, you know, anywhere at the time. The screens were touch sensitive. It was all highly networked. And I was just seduced.
Yeah.
So I ended up, over the course of a number of years, my whole trajectory shifted from thinking I wanted to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
Then I wanted to be an economics professor. And then I ended up in this computer land.
Yeah, sure. Can you tell us a little bit about Plato? Because I remember that this is stuff that was back in the days. This is before the Apple II, before graphics was commonly available to the average person. And it's amazing stuff.
Yeah, so go back to 1972. I was working with a system that was higher resolution graphics. I think IBM did it with its PC. Oh, gosh. The XT didn't even have graphics as good as Plato. So it was a higher resolution. You know, Apple brought out the mouse, so at least you had some physical gesturing, but the resolution was higher than a Macintosh, you know, early days. There are two things that I think made it really unique. One was it was all network. So everything that was done was responsive to networking and connecting people in different ways. So we had threaded discussion groups. We had online chats. And this is all going on in the 70s.
Right.
So before the internet, before the PC. The other thing that was interesting is this was completely optimized for education. So every decision that was made was about how will we use this massive. It was running basically on a supercomputer, control data supercomputer. And our Plato terminals here at UH were running on a phone line back to Illinois. A lot of this, you know, CDC supercomputer at the University of Illinois. But it was an environment optimized and a programming language developed specifically for creating educational software.
And so you came to Hawaii to implement this year.
Yeah, so President Fudge Matsuda was the president
In
most of the 70s. And was at a MIT engineering PhD. And so in the mid-70s, he decided this computer stuff was going to make a difference to how we teach and learn. And so he sent a team from UH around all of the major systems in the country that were doing educational technology. And one of the stops was at the University of Illinois to see a Plato lab. And by then, I was an undergraduate student programming. So I worked my way through school. I was writing software on Plato to teach. And the team came back to Hawaii and they said, "We want to now do a pilot project, including Plato." So it's a pretty complicated system. So they wanted somebody cheap to help them get started. So 1977, I showed up here on a one-year half-time contract for $750 a month, and I kind of never went back. But I was a Play-Doh guy. So, you know, by the time you came, I think we may have already, did we have the Play-Doh system by then or not? Yeah, so we got a small control data, more like a mini computer. We were actually running Play-Doh locally, but it was connected to all the other Play-Doh systems as well. We still kept a phone line because all of these things were highly networked.
I did it during the pandemic, especially when distance learning became not just a nice to have or it'd be great to have, but you got to have. Did it influence what you did back then at all?
You know, 100%? So what I'll say, I mean, I'm saddened at how little, you know, some education has learned from systems like Play-Doh that were really focused on how do you create high quality interactive materials. So now when people talk about an online course, lots of times they're just talking about a Zoom because it's online. You're on your computer, on the internet. It's like, but what we were really doing then was individualized instruction that would, you know, essentially provide some information, present screen, and then challenge the learner to do something. The most insulting thing you could say about a lesson back then was, oh, that's just a page turner, meaning put up a page of content, press the screen, put up a page of content. And I still get educational content now when I have to go through online training for, you know, ethics or Title IX. That's super common. We would never allow that. We would always put up something and then ask a question of some kind, require a response, and then, like a human teacher would do, based on the response, you would go off and remediate in some different way to help the student actually understand what's going on.
I think psychologists call it unit mastery.
So the thing with unit mastery is that stuff really wasn't doing the teaching. That was just doing the checking out. So I think the thing, like the unit mastery is cool, and we did that also. But the unit mastery things we did is you're in psychology. I think when I first met unit mastery stuff at UH, we also provided the instructional content, not the you fail, go back and meet. So when you put those two things together, you can really do a pretty amazing job of individualized education that lets people both wind their own way through the content, skip the stuff they already know because you can test out of it. But also, if you're struggling, really help with the instructional presentation, the teaching.
It's interesting you say that. You know, my regular podcast host, John Westphal, is a psychology professor at Delta State University. And we talk about distance learning and computer-assisted learning and all kinds of stuff every now and then. He's pretty much still told you he was much better than both of us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we learned a lot about how to do this, but we don't really want to spend the money and time to do it really well.
So the lessons learned really weren't learned enough yet.
I think that's right. I don't want to sell short what we did during the pandemic and basically higher education did across the country. I mean, we did a pivot from when we realized this the disaster, you know, kind of in I'm gonna say mid-March or so, and we said, we're not coming back from spring break. And we pivoted, you know, essentially not quite 100%, probably 98% of our courses online, mostly using things like Zoom. We had a learning management system within every course already had an online presence. We had Zoom licenses. We had firewalls for people to work from home. So we really mostly just had to scale everything out. So from things maybe 10% of one person using to 100%.
It'll be interesting in the future. I mean, I guess we won't be going in, but or the large language models should be integrated into, you know, into learning in general.
I think that's super interesting. I agree with you. I just saw a really interesting piece written by blanket on his name, but I don't even know how I came across it. But he made the assertion that what really matters with the large language models is the prompt. It's all about the prompt. And he laid out in an interesting way how to establish a set of prompts. Like, So the typical thing you see, example of like, explain photosynthesis to me as if I'm a 5-year-old.
Right.
So that doesn't really teach you anything. That just gives you a spiel, which may or may not be full of hallucinations. So he laid out a prompt, set of prompts actually, to say, this is how you're going to teach photosynthesis.
Right.
And then what the LLM does is it figures out within that framework how to be responsive to how the learner responds. It really, you know, I just saw this over the weekend. It really intrigued me. When I started working on my PhD here at UH, one of the topics I considered doing a dissertation on was, at the time we called it intelligent tutoring system, but basically AI for computer-assisted instruction.
Right.
So how do you take it to the next level? And so this is now late 80s, and the state of the art wasn't very far along, but I think like looking at this now, whatever that is, 35 years later, there's probably stuff we can do that this was really intriguing.
Yeah, I think so too. I look back at some of the stuff I did back in the 80s when I was trying to do automated diagnosis, like how psychotic event. And I just didn't have the horsepower to do a lot of stuff that, you know, my models are pretty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, sort of another thing then to now, you know, just thinking about horsepower, you know, not even going to the cloud, you know, and all that's available there. But so this Plato thing ran in the 70s on an entire room full of control data supercomputer.
Right.
And now, you know, I mentioned there was an Ars Technica article just within the last couple of weeks. I don't follow it, but somebody sent it to me. And there's multiple Plato systems running on like PCs and guys.
Right. I read that article.
Yeah. So, I mean, I actually got to log on, and I've gone back and looked at some of my old software. The first piece of software that I got paid to write, which was on Plato, this is an astonishing crossover. It was using Plato to teach students how to use applied rule.
Oh, wow.
We did not get that slide rules would be gone because there were microcomputers at the time.
Right. Yeah. And calculators are enormously expensive.
And when I was, I think I'm a little bit older than you.
Yeah.
When I took college chemistry, this was a point of debate where they would seem to be allowed to use calculators because it was an unfair advantage over people who couldn't afford them and have to use slide rule. Right. And we were not allowed to use, I didn't have one anyway, we were not allowed to use calculators.
I remember seeing my nickels and dimes in college to buy an 1825C.
Yeah.
You know, which had continuous men.
There you go.
And it's really good, buddy. What the
heck? Yep. And you learn your recurrent.
Exactly. Greatest thing ever. But that brings me to another thing I wanted to ask you about, and that's related to this whole business is broadband. That's the other thing you're looking for.
It's interesting because one of the things, you know, we both worked at here, they ever left than sort of evolving into different organizations, heading the thing that sort of sucked the computing center in with all the other technology organizations on campus. But one of the things I loved about it, well, I started with Plato, and so I was the Plato guy for probably, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years, including being responsible with my partner in crime, Jeff Blomberg, for the control data server that we ran our Plato on, a mini computer. But I mean, just being in this business during the years that we were in this business, you know, I remember the, you know, PCs came out, and there were Apple IIs, but they didn't really make a dent in a big way.
Yeah.
But when the PC came out, that was like credibility for the microcomputer.
Right.
And, you know, I remember the day we did our first PC sale at UH, we had 500 people waiting in line to get our PC through. Yeah. So I mean, because so many, I hate to say this about many state workers, because it's certainly not all state workers. There's people like, my job is X, you and I were chatting about this. This is what I do, and it defines me. And I was like, wow, PCs, these things are really cool. I'm going to learn about those. I, you know, like work on the assembly code for Kermit to make it run in our environments and stuff like that, to be able to do uploads or downloads to that old IBM 3705 communication front end. And then Macintoshes came out. Then Macintoshes came out, and our I think our mutual friend, Kim Bridges, showed me my first Macintosh.
Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, I remember him doing it. I think it was him. He did a demo in the art building. But what convinced me that these are something special, folks were in Illinois. My mom was like a first grade teacher, and I went home.
Yeah.
And my mom had gotten a Macintosh. They pitched themselves as being for educators.
Right.
My mom never touched technology.
Right.
And she was like making Valentine cards for her kid and printing them out on her dot matrix printer. And, you know, the graphics
are
fabulous. And, you know, you could cut and paste things. And I just remember thinking, they have figured out something that my mom can use for something
and
left to do. So I went back to the computing center. I called the guy who was our boss. He was there for quite a while. Still, I saw him for his 90th birthday, Walter Yee, at a 90th birthday party a few years ago. Anyway, I said, these Macintoshes are really cool. We need to get some. And he was a pretty hardcore IBM guy, I got to say. But, you know, he let me get one. And then when the Apple salesman came to town, the way he cracked the market with Macintosh, he was very clever. He donated 10 like Mac Pluses or whatever the model was at the time, and a laser printer. They had the first, you know, customer-friendly laser printers as well. We put them in a small lab in Keller Hall, and Walter, who was the director of the computing center, 2 months later could come up and see there's a line for the Mac lab all the time, and the PCs, you could always get one.
Yeah.
And he goes, okay, there's something here to that. So, you know, that's the stuff that I just feel like I was so fortunate to have the opportunity to, you know, set directions on things because nobody else really wanted to, because there was nobody in charge of stuff that didn't exist.
Yeah.
At the time, their job descriptions were written. So I just got to do interesting things that were in nobody else's job description for that.
I remember you, I think you were the first person that I knew personally who had a Mac in his office. I mean, people had Macs in like a common shared area.
Yeah, I had asked Walter to buy one because I thought it was important for somebody to know something about them.
Yes.
Yeah, I actually had a Mac PC in my office for a while, but I was kind of the de facto, as we called them back then, microcomputer support.
I remember I was jealous because I had a VP100 term.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and one of the things I loved doing was, how do you get your microcomputer to big computer?
Yeah.
Because that was a big part of it. I spent a lot of time working on terminal emulators and this Kermit software that I found from Columbia University that I thought was brilliant, and it was open source and it was free.
Yeah.
So I did tinkering around on that. I remember an early, guess it was a PC. So it was a PC because all it had was two floppy drives. And Kermit was written in assembly language. So when I was digging with it, I had to keep switching the disks because you had to put the assembler disk in. There was no hard drive. You put the assembler disk in, you know, and then the good old day. I mean, the other thing that I think, you know, this is a little prior to getting super involved in what is broadband today, but I also worked with my partner in crime on a lot of this stuff was Jeff Lombert, who was really doing a lot of data communication for no particular reason. But it was another one of the things it's like nobody was in charge of. We had phone lines running around, but that was about it. So when we started running fiber and things like that, is and network protocols and how to connect things up. You know, we had, you know, dueling network protocol, right?
Yeah.
You know, the IBM guys were doing SNA and Token Ring, and DEC people had DECnet,
right?
And Novell had whatever that thing was called.
NetWare,
they had a network protocol.
IPX,
yeah.
Yeah.
Apple had AppleFi.
Right.
And we had a guy at the University of Faculty Member of the Computer Science Department named Torben Nielsen.
I remember Torben.
And he was the guy who, more than anybody, helped bring the internet to the web. And once I figured out what that was, like, this is going to do it. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make all of this stuff work over internet protocols. So as I sort of ascended the responsibility ladder, one of the things I did at UH was declare that the only supported protocol between buildings and leaving campus was going to be TCP/IP.
Right.
And all of those other things could run, but they had to they were going to get out of this building. So we had like Gator boxes for Apple Talk.
And I forgot about those.
And then I remember spending a bunch of time with in one of my jobs figuring out how to get IP. I know it's funny that it's IPX, but Novell running over IP with these little packet drivers that you could get running over your Ethernet card and doing all of that kind of fun, really fun sorts of projects. And then as Torben wanted to be more of a computer science professor and less of a network operator, sort of becoming more responsible for deploying internet. So we had some clashes with people at the state that were actually still trying to run X.25 networks to connect all the islands and things like that over like 56 kilobit lines.
Frame relays and stuff.
Yeah, frame relays. We were like, we just want the fastest link we can, we want Ethernet, and we want to just write TCP. We butted, but it all worked out okay.
It did.
And, you know, speaking of VT100, we just said VT100 is the terminal protocol, and you can use it on almost anything. I mean, other than those, the IBM mainframe stuff, you still need it, pretty much IBM compatible terminals, but you could function with a VT100 on those as well. So I sort of got pretty involved in the internet world quite early. And in fact, when the champion of X.25 left the state, and the next guy was in charge at about, it might have been called the CSD then. I think it was after
ICSD.
It was ICSD. And we were talking about this. He said, I don't know how I'm ever going to, that we were making the first for our statewide network buying the early routers. Cisco ended up winning the business that particular time. And they bought an extra one to give the state start to crack them, because they weren't doing anything with TCP/IP at all. And that sort of broke the jinx, and then they could start to say, oh, this is our protocol. And then they could add stuff to that.
Yeah, the state ran NetWare, IPX, well into the 2000s. I don't think they went fully TCP/IP till 2000/2007.
Yeah.
Something like that. And even then, there are pockets of weirdness. There's WangNet.
There was still WangNet around. Yeah, that's right. Like
that.
I would pronounce it. Still some way sitting around.
No, they're all.
They are all gone. Okay. Okay. Good job, Todd. You probably helped with that.
I really want the other thing. Right, WangNet used to come in these silvery pipes to route Wang itself, to route all the key. And they're works of art. And I so much wanted to take one. And actually, they were willing to dig one. But it was so large, I thought, oh, my wife's going to kill me. It was like, 8x10.
No, we had a Wang word processor in the computing center for a while, but that was about it. And then within 2 or 3 years, we were all word processing.
Yeah.
On our microcomputers.
Although we did, if you remember, when the IDC initial sales, we went with word processor, whose name I can't remember, that was basically our emulation of the Wang word processor.
Yeah, well, those updates. You remember that?
Yeah.
That allowed us to get rid of the link.
Yeah, that's true.
That is, let them have some more control. Multimate,
that's right. That was the Wang.
That was the Wang.
Yeah.
Which was easy to use.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. Yes. So, but then you got involved, then did the NTIA BTOP?
Yeah. So, somewhere along your line. So, the mid-90s, I started learning about applying for federal grants. And so, in the 90s, we started getting some NSF grants. DOV on high-speed fiber optic connections. Be able to support our ever-growing appetite for internet. Then I think my next one was early 2001, we won the contract to run the Maui Supercomputing Center. We already did. Then we won a big DoD project called Pacific Disaster, also on Maui. And then, so this is the Great Recession, with the financial crisis.
Yes, I remember.
There was this BTOP, was a federal program out of NTIA and the Department of Commerce. It was a combination of focus on broadband, but it was also a shovel-ready project, get people to work support economic growth initiative. And so we at UA, we had a really good team. We put in a proposal to pull fiber to every public school, public library, and UHR actually already had fiber to pretty much all of our locations.
Yeah.
And then activate networks. So it was a mix of fiber deployment, Wave Division multiplexing gear to utilize the fiber, and then some kind of TCP/IP router and device to deploy within the campus or building, depending on where we were. So we actually accomplished it. It was about a $45 million project. And we were the first state in the country that actually had dedicated fiber to every public school and public library, except on every island.
Yeah, because remember, you couldn't get rights away to Hana.
No, you know, we did something. Yeah, we didn't pull fiber to Hana. That was we couldn't get rights away, right? So we had to shoot microwave. But we got broadband.
We did, absolutely.
We did. We shot a very complicated microwave shot off of Haleakala with about...
I actually went to go visit all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, because we had state stuff coexisting. Yeah, we were not... That particular grant was only focused on education and library. Although we had a companion grant that also let us buy 400 or 500 devices for public libraries, which included school libraries, public libraries, and university libraries for members of the public to go in and access the internet.
Yeah.
You know, for the big pitch was they're going to be able to go in and look for jobs and apply for jobs or, you know, do their resumes and things like that. But, you know, they could do all kinds of other stuff. So, you know, now it's really fun because there's another round of these things going on. So that time to go inter-island, we had to buy capacity from carriers on the inter-island pieces because all of, you know, both state library system, the state DOE system, and the state higher ed equipment system are all on every island.
Right.
So that was part of the arc.
Yeah. When I was with the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, I actually went to go visit a lot of the school, the K-12 sites, as well as a few others.
Yeah.
I got to see them in person.
So the cable TV division inside Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs was one of our amazing partners because they control it's not really regulation, with the franchising of cable TV in Hawaii. So we got all of this done. The only way we could do it for $45 million as an end user was because it was built into the cable franchise to provide us fiber essentially at cost for state purposes. But at the time it was Oceanic, now
Spectrum.
Yeah, I think there was something in between, maybe.
Time Warner.
Yeah, they went from Oceanic to Time Warner.
Right. The Charters.
Charter.
Yeah.
Anyway, they were a great partner in doing all of that work as well. And really, they just really helped. Yeah, they were a super partner. So DCCA enabled all of that.
Yeah, that was lots of fun.
Lots of fun. And it's still the basis. I mean, we've upgraded and done a lot since then, but that really put in, you know, a common architecture that can be leveraged today because you just, you know, you upgrade the stuff on the ends, you know, fiber, that fiber's, I don't want to say unlimited capacity, but we're certainly not stretching the limits of what it can do.
Yeah.
I remember explaining WDM to everybody in the early days that they didn't quite get. Just picture it like you have a red light and a blue light and a green light, and they don't interfere with each other. So it's however fast they pull.
Yeah. The amazing thing about fiber to me is that everybody kept telling us, well, you know, we're going to run out of capacity because, you know, the fiber's only going to... And then those laser engineers, they just go, I think...
Well, they're still, you know... Yeah, we were pushing it, you know, in the early days with a gigabit, 10 gigabits, and now, I mean... 400 gigabit waves are common over long hauls now. It's expensive, but it lets you leverage the fiber in an interesting way. It's
cheaper than laying new fiber in the ocean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that, you know, sort of changed this game for Hawaii, for better and for worse, was the, you know, all of the fiber across the Pacific used to stop here.
Yeah.
So we were sort of like the airplanes had to stop here on their way somewhere. And...
Which is also no longer true.
Yeah, and then that's also no longer true, exactly. They figured out the technology for fiber. So we were getting bypassed for a really long time. So around the time of that BTOP, I got appointed to and ended up getting elected the chair of the state's first, called the Hawaii Broadband Task Force. And one of the things, I had become involved in a lot of the Pacific fiber stuff through the Pacific Telecom Council and Conference, was that we needed to be proactive in attracting projects to stop here, because they were bypassing us for two reasons. One, we weren't a very big market other than DOD. But secondly, as with so many things in Hawaii, we're a nightmare to do a project. So the number of permits, permissions, neighborhood board, postponement. And I got this idea, can we just build an open cable landing station and do all of the pre-permitting and run pipes out to the ocean?
Yeah.
So that when somebody wants, you know, shows up and says, hey, I'm thinking of pulling fiber to you, it's clearly in our best interest to have them do it. We just say, okay, we got it all built. All you have to do is pull the fiber in, which doesn't, you know, there's no soil or water touch to do that. No, I'm sure lying around that. So we're trying to do that now with all of the Biden infrastructure bills. There's a ton of broadband money in there, in multiple agencies for different kinds of things. And there's a lot of attention to tribal land, all of those bills, thanks to our congressional delegation, everything that's designed to help, you know, a massive reservation that has now even has cell phones. There's a comparable program for DHHL here in Hawaii. So because we're sort of recognized as having kind of more capacity and expertise on this than others, public sector in the state, the government certainly know that this. We are the lead now for all of the broadband infrastructure projects using the COVID pandemic stimulus kind of money as well. So we've got some really interesting projects that will be coming out over the months and years to come, I think, that will be really transformational for the state.
When you look back, are you like me, just standing there in amazement at how far we've come?
Oh, yeah.
I just feel
so fortunate. It's like all of these coincidences in my life, from, you know, this guy in my math class taking me into Plato, it really reshaped, you know, my interest in computing. I mean, they were not that interesting back then. I was doing paper tapes and punch cards.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I'm like in this amazing environment, you know, to getting this like 1 year halftime gig in Hawaii that never ended, to, you know, always having interesting jobs at UH, to then, you know, stumbling into this last thing that I never planned on, to be, you know, ending up being the longest serving president in this place for
ever.
70 years. No, not forever, but is that forever, probably.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty close to forever.
No. UH was founded in 1907. So I guess I'm the longest in the second half of its history.
Yeah. And definitely,
I think the jobs were easier at the, well, it's easy to look back on and think, yeah, it was easier at the beginning, but they probably had some challenges I can't even imagine.
Including two world wars.
Yes.
A few things like that. Yep. Yeah.
Exactly.
Not that you were not without challenges in your
career. Yeah.
Not up to and not, in, you know, including COVID. The pandemic.
COVID, probably COVID and Mauna Kea were my two hardest.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, you know, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, my pleasure.
It has been a fantastic
time. Yeah, good catching up, too. Thanks for lunch.
You're welcome. Anyway, that was Dr. David Lasner, President of the University of Hawaii. It has been my privilege to talk to you one more time.